Welcome to the Coaching Revealed podcast series on health and wellness coaching. I'm one of the podcast hosts, Austin Matzell. In today's episode, Dr. Jeff Hull, the executive director at the Institute of Coaching, interviews Natasha Bowman, a renowned speaker, consultant, and advocate for mental health and psychological safety in the workplace. Natasha shares her journey from her time as an attorney and her own mental health work that led to her advocacy today. She champions the role healthy workplaces have on our mental well-being. Natasha highlights the significance of organizational culture in supporting mental well-being and urges leaders to prioritize trust building and ongoing assessment. She stresses the need for coaches to remain present, listen to the diverse perspectives, and adapt strategies accordingly. When it comes to how an organization deals with health and wellness, Natasha notes how important it is for the leadership to be prepared to hear what is working for their employees and what policies may be detrimental. Join us as we discuss Natasha's insights into creating psychologically safe environments and promoting mental wellness in today's fast-paced world. Thank you for tuning in to Coaching Revealed. Let's get started.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to the Institute of Coaching podcast, Coaching Revealed. My name is Jeffrey Hull. I'm the executive director of the Institute of Coaching, and I am super excited to be here today with Natasha Bowman, a top leadership voice in the world of workplace mental health. Natasha is an attorney. She is a consultant, an executive coach, and she has been with us a couple of times in the past to discuss her own personal story, but also her amazing work that she does through her own institute focused on workplace well-being. So I want to get started with Natasha, but before I do, let me just give you a little bit of her background. She has been a consultant and the president of Natasha Bowman Consulting Group for many years. She has served a large number of clients, including Forbes, Hearst Magazines, and many other organizations like Georgetown University, Fordham University, Jack Welch Management Institute. She is a best-selling author who has written a book recently called Crazy AF, How to Go from Being Burned Out, Unmotivated, and Unhappy to Reclaiming Your Mental Health at Work, which was an Amazon number one bestseller last year in 23. And she is really an incredible advocate for promoting workplace equity and mental wellness across the spectrum in nonprofits, for-profits, entrepreneurial, and all different kinds of organizations. She's the co-founder of the Bowman Foundation for Workplace Equity and Mental Wellness and a board member at NAMI New York City. So I am super excited to be with you here today, Natasha. And, you know, since the last time we spoke, you have been busy on the speaking circuit, busy on the consulting circuit. And maybe the best place for us to start is for those listening who don't know you, to give a little bit of your background, because you have kind of a very special, unique story. Yeah. And then to dive into what you see as the current workplace trends, some of the wellness issues that we're grappling with post-COVID. But let's hear a little bit about your own personal story to start.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me back again. I always enjoy these conversations and partnerships with the Institute of Coaching. My background, like you said, it's a little unique in how I got here. I started out as a labor and employment law attorney, then decided to go over to the HR side. I didn't want to be on the dark side of misconduct in the workplace, wanted to try to prevent it. So went over to HR and sat at the head of HR for several corporate organizations, as well as healthcare organizations, including, ironically, behavioral health. And I started my consulting firm that started as Performance Renew and now known as the Natasha Bowman Consulting Group, along with teaching at those universities that you just mentioned and writing books. And I had, during COVID, when I was in the beginning of 2020, when I kind of considered myself at the top of my career, I received those accolades that you talked about, being named the top 30 global guru in management and a, you know, Power 200 leadership. I'd done my TED talk and, you know, written my first book. Life couldn't have been better. Then the pandemic happened. And during the pandemic, I, like many, many people across the globe, experienced a mental health crisis and attempted suicide. And after that attempt, I was hospitalized in a mental health facility. And it was while I was hospitalized that I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. That diagnosis explained a lot about myself, and not necessarily in a negative way. A lot of times when we think about mental health and serious mental illnesses, the media will tell us that, oh, these people are not functional and can't accomplish things. And what I learned is that my diagnosis actually helped to propel a lot of my professional success. And but what really made me reflect was my labor and employment law background. And it really, now that I had this lived experience, I realized that organizations weren't doing enough to promote mental well-being in the workplace. You know, as the head of HR, I thought, oh, we have an EAP program. We offer medical insurance. So surely, you know, we're doing our, you know, our workforce has access and they fit the things that they need, but they don't. And I realized that after my experience and after many people reached out to me to share their experiences, that there was so much more that we need to be doing in workplaces to promote and protect mental health.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that having had a personal experience yourself of a breakdown, even though you had been super successful, it's really incredible statement of your authenticity and also your compassion and your honesty to come forth and describe your situation and to become an advocate for workplace well-being at a whole different level from what you were already doing even before you had that.
Yeah,
and I think I just, that's what one of the things we at the Institute really appreciate is that as coaches, we see these kinds of things. You know, we see highly successful leaders who may be in a really difficult place or may have been avoiding a diagnosis or not even aware. You know, having someone like yourself who's been through this and come out on the other side and become an advocate, what are the kinds of things that you see organizations stepping up that are doing better? What are they doing?
Yeah, so first of all, what I am just really, really proud of is that organizations are now opening these conversations about mental health. You know, before they were discouraged, I was guilty, you know, of discouraging leaders, you know, to talk about mental health issues with their workforce and their teams. It's like, nope, don't say that. It's, you know, legal liability, et cetera, et cetera. And then I realized there's not equity right in that, because if someone were, if you had a team member that came to you and said, hey, I've been diagnosed with cancer, we would not shun them. We wouldn't say, oh, I can't hear that. Go to EAP, go to HR. I can't talk about it. We would want to know as managers, right, more about it, the details, how could I support you, et cetera, et cetera. So we were recreating within ourselves inequities in how we treated illnesses, right? And mental illnesses were shunned, whereas other illnesses were getting more empathy and support. So one of the first things that I'm seeing is that organizations are inviting and welcoming these conversations. I'm also seeing with that, now that we know that so many people are struggling with their mental health or need support, we're providing more access. We're realizing that EAP, you know, may not be enough. You get so many visits and then you're off, you know, on your own to find your own provider. So then we think, okay, medical insurance kicks in. It does kick in, but we have a mental health provider shortage. So just because I have medical insurance doesn't mean that I have access and I can easily attain a mental health provider, let alone maybe one that's culturally competent. So what I'm seeing them do is to provide more supplemental, right? Whether it's through an on-demand app or things like that, where people can have immediate access to mental health coverage. And lastly, what I'm seeing a little bit of progress, but where I would like to see more, and this is where my coaching comes in, because when I think about workplace, right, we have a unique opportunity to not just be able to provide mental health coverage for those who need it, because there are certain things within our workplaces that are contributing, right, to the psychological stressors that many people are experiencing and why they need, you know, mental health guidance. And so what I've done a lot of my coaching is we've got to look at the cultural things, right? Those psychological risks within our culture to determine if there are threats to mental health within our workplaces, right? You're going to have people like me who have been diagnosed with a mental health condition, and there's nothing, you know, I've had it for, you know, now I know 20 plus years, and yes, I'm going to need treatment, et cetera. But you also have a large group of people who had not been diagnosed, and it's nothing genetic or anything. There are just certain workplace stressful factors that are in place that we can absolutely control as workplaces to eliminate those workplace stressors so that we can improve the mental health. And that's where a lot of my coaching comes in, is to go in and to assess your workplace culture and to help you to remove those threats to mental health so that you can have a healthier workplace.
Yeah, no, I love that. I think that the cultural environment and the way the leaders operate and the intersection of the two things really is key to the success of creating an environment for high performance and health and well-being. Talk to me about what you're seeing when you're coaching leaders or teams that are interested in creating an environment that's more conducive to well-being. And what are the kinds of things you're coaching them to do? And what are they open to versus what are they maybe a little bit resistant to? What are you running into?
Yes. I mean, well, they're open to having the conversation, which is great, and open to the assessment. And we do that through surveys, through focus groups, you know, so that's great. You know, I think that's a major first step, is to be open to assessing your culture. And then getting that feedback. And I kind of put together a heat map where you can see where those risks are, where you're doing well in terms of certain structural things, policies, et cetera. And then there's the people aspect to it, where there may be people that need additional coaching because perhaps their leadership style, right, is not, you know, conducted to a healthy work environment. And that's where I probably see kind of the most pushback, right? Because a lot of times the leaders that are putting the stress upon the employees, what organizations are considering high performers, right? Maybe they are the breadwinners, they get the great clients, whatever that may be. But organizations are prioritizing those things, what they consider to be success in the organization, over their leadership capabilities, their ability to create these healthy and psychologically safe teams. And so that's where there's a lot of work that needs to be done, is that putting that priority and still making that case that if the workplace is not feeling psychologically safe, they're not mentally well because of this leadership behavior, then we can consider them a successful leader. So we have some organizations that are open to that feedback and open to getting these leaders more coaching, more training, et cetera, et cetera. And then some that are pushing back. And unfortunately, what I see over time is a lot of times those behaviors aren't addressed until there's a significant incident, right? All of a sudden, this leader is in the New York Times because, come to find out, for the past 10 years, they've been creating this hostile work environment. I'm like, yep, told you so. Like, we saw this coming. And so what I would love for organizations to do is not wait for those, you know, significant events to happen, right? Where you have not only really harm the person, the victims that are involved by, you know, because of their behavior, but now you're dealing with this media or whatever this fallout is. Let's be more proactive and realize, yeah, short term, you're getting what you need from this leader you think you are, but long term, right, their behaviors are going to show up in an adverse way somewhere down the line.
Ready to advance your coaching practice? Join the Institute of Coaching and tap into the world's leading resource for coaching science and professional development. With over 4,000 members across 130 countries, the IOC offers invaluable networking opportunities with an elite global coaching community and innovative learning to broaden your knowledge and keep you at the forefront of coaching best practices. Engage in cutting-edge learning events with world-renowned coaching scholars, from webinars and seminars to discussion groups, research projects, and more. Try any membership free for 30 days. Use promo code IOC Podcast and visit instituteofcoaching.org/join to get started.
Right. No, absolutely. It's like, don't wait until things fall apart before you're finally putting some band-aids on the system.
Right? Yes. Exactly.
Talk to me a little bit about what you're seeing from a multicultural, multigender, multigenerational standpoint, because it seems like a couple of things are happening at the same time. One, you have environments now, workplaces that have 3, 4, even 5 generations working uh-huh. together. A lot of people uh-huh. are working later in their careers. They're not retiring as quickly. And then you have young people who want to move quickly, Gen Z, Gen X, and millennials that are not going to deal with seniority systems the way they used to.
Yep.
So you have multi-generational, but then you also have multicultural, you know, we mm-hmm. have environments mm-hmm. where people from all different parts of the world, mm-hmm. and then multiracial people mm-hmm. of color that are stepping up and becoming into more leadership roles, mm-hmm. more women
yep.
stepping into leadership roles in the C-suite. But I'm curious, how are you finding all of that complexity to play out in terms of trying to advocate for well-being? Talk to me about what you're seeing, because you're in the mix, as they say.
I'm in the mix, and it's quite complex. In fact, I have a LinkedIn learning course out right now talking about that intersectionality of DEI and mental health. Because we've got to take, like you said, that multiple identity into consideration as we're forming and strategizing our mental wellness plans. And what I'm seeing out there, you have Gen Z, your younger workers who are way more open to talking about their mental health, prioritizing their mental health, putting boundaries in place. However, what we're seeing with the older generation is, what is this? What do you mean a mental health day? What do you mean you've got this? You know, I've been right. working for years and through all these such and such, and I get up and I go to work 40 hours a week. And so we are seeing that kind of tug of war happening. And at the same time, we're actually seeing leaders, organizational leaders who, you know, just so happen to be in some of the older generations, they're kind of pulling back and saying, oh, hey, yeah, we gave you this mental break during COVID and the year or two following. But hey, let's go back to where we were pre-COVID. Let's come back to work full time. Let's come back to the office. Forget the mental health days.
Is that a backlash?
I don't know if it's a backlash or it's a lack of trust. I can't see what you're doing, and I'm just assuming that you're doing other things besides working. And what we're seeing, we're not seeing the numbers show that, though. They're going against what the data is telling us. The data it was telling us that, you know, work from home or, you know, hybrid work environments were successful. People were actually being more productive, right? And people were being more healthy and taking less days off, et cetera, et cetera. And for some reason, that trust factor kind of kicked in. I don't know if it's because of social media and you're seeing people out, you know, taking a walk in the middle of the day. So if you're doing that, how are you doing this? Right. And so it's the trust, right? I think that's the biggest issue of why we're seeing a lot of people, you know, a lot of leaders. In fact, I just read an article. I can't remember what organization it is, but they did a whole video like, come back to work. You know, I need you back. You know, this whole video advertisement. I can't remember what organization, but we're seeing that more and more. But we're seeing the resistance, right, from the younger generation. Like, no, well, I guess I got to go and, you know, go somewhere else. And we're also seeing less and less work from home jobs. So that from a generational standpoint is definitely a complexity. And I don't know where we're going to land. It's this tug of war. We'll have to see.
Yeah, that's it's a great question. Talk to me about the, mm-hmm. so if you're coaching a leader, and let's mm-hmm. say it is a boomer, you know, a baby boomer or mm-hmm. Gen X, you know, someone mm-hmm. who's had 10, 15, 20 years experience, but they've yep. been through the pandemic. So they have yep. some sense of how important well-being mm-hmm. is in today's world. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do you coach them on in terms of how to effectively get high performance from those younger generations, from mm-hmm. the diverse population?
Right.
And sort of work through those trust issues. What do you recommend?
Yes, and I have been. I wrote about it in my book, you know, because I was seeing these, you know, come back to the physical work environment policies, and they were very, very arbitrary. They were very, oh, I want you back 2 days a week or 3 days a week. And I would ask, like, so how'd you come up with that number? You know, what's okay. the plan? What's the, you know, and they really didn't have an answer. It was just kind of, we just think 3 days a week. So I'm like, okay, if you want 3 days a week, what's happening? Are they there on the same 3 days? Are you doing something meaningful to make sure? Because they were saying, oh, they need connection. They need this. And, okay, are you making sure that everyone is back on those same 3 days? Or do you have one person that's sitting there on Monday by themselves on Zoom call? So therefore, not only is there a trust issue in the leadership, but you're also creating a trust issue within your workplace, right? Because now it's, now I know you don't trust me, so I don't trust you because you're telling me I'm coming back for this reason. That's not happening. So I made the business case of why it's so important that leaders, you know, instill that sense of trust within their workforce. And when you're doing these arbitrary return to the office policies and you're not being intentional and purposeful with it, guess what? You're going to lose your best, right? And let's look at your data. I have them to sit down and say, well, let's look at your productivity. Did you meet your KPIs, et cetera, when you had a mostly work from home? And if they did, we talked through the whys. You know, I talked them through getting to see this has nothing to do with in your head, your emotional state of you thinking, I've got to look at you. You've got to be in the office in order for us to be successful. This is, you know, because the numbers, the math isn't mathing, as they say, you know, the numbers are showing something quite different, right? So again, I understand that you may have fear that there's no connection to each other. There's no connection to the job. That's fine. We can address that, but let's not be arbitrary at it. Let's not just say a policy, come back 2 days a week, and you don't have anything planned during that time to, right, facilitate what you think these goals are. So we're still working through that. And again, I don't know where we land. We've got some leaders that are, yep, I got it. You know, we've got to, you know, do something more meaningful, or that was just arbitrary. And then we've got those that, you know, from an economic standpoint, right? So they're getting a lot of pressure from city officials, you know, especially like here in New York City. Our mayor, you know, had a call for bring people back to the office. If they're not working, then we're losing small businesses because your bodega or your Starbucks or whatever on the corner that's by Grand Central Station, they're not getting the foot traffic. Or so they're getting kind of they're pulling different directions where you've got government officials that are saying we need people back in the streets so they can buy things, so they can order things, and, you know, all this foot traffic, or we don't need these big empty office buildings, et cetera, et cetera. And then you've got your workforce saying, but we can do this. So there's got to be a medium ground that you've just got to work through strategically. And it's going to be different organization by organization, but you got to be willing to put that work in and not just say, okay, everybody come back to work 3 days a week, the end, because that's what I'm seeing right now. From a cultural standpoint that you talked about, and you talked about more women in the C-suite. And I'm glad that we're seeing that. We're not seeing more women in the CEO role as it relates to Fortune 500. In fact, we've seen that number decrease. We're not seeing what we thought we would be seeing after a lot of our efforts. And those that are not necessarily in Fortune 500 that are not tracked so broadly, what I'm hearing is exactly what I talked about early in the conversation. Yes, I'm the first, I'm the only, I was excited to get that role. But now that I'm here, this culture is not welcoming of the different perspectives that I bring. And it's taking a mental toll. And we're seeing people leave the C-suite, especially women of color, leave those positions. We had just someone in higher education last week that actually died by suicide because of her work environment. It was a VP. So we're seeing those types of things happening. So again, when it comes to mental well-being, you can have all the apps you want. You can have all the weight loss, but all these step challenges, all these things that you can that we think goes into mental well-being, even your work from home. However, if your culture is riddled with these psychological stressors, all of those mean nothing. I can go to therapy all day long, But if I walk into my workplace and I'm experiencing microaggressions, if I don't have a sense of belonging, my voice isn't heard, right? That therapy session means nothing. You've got to align those things.
Yeah, that's really beautifully said. I mean, I think that it feels a little bit like one step forward, two steps back. Mm-hmm. And so I'm saddened to hear that the C-suite is not filling up with women and people of color and more right. diversity, but hopefully it's a blip and that the long-term trajectory will be going in the right direction. I'm curious to hear, when you're talking about moving away from arbitrary policymaking, which I think is a really good point, and being more thoughtful about creating a psychologically safe culture, what are some of the key, I always envision that it's a conversation that has to happen between the leader and the staff. Like what would be the right number of days to come into the office? It's a conversation that you can have with the leader and the staff together, so they can almost co-create.
Exactly. Just don't be off. Let's talk about what works, because at the same time, we're also dealing with an epidemic of loneliness as a result of the pandemic, right? So not everyone has someone at home, and in that going to the office was their sense of connection with people, right. et cetera, et cetera. Again, it goes back to, let's talk to our workforce. Let's see what works for you, right? And maybe it's not a policy that covers everyone. I'm loving the some of my clients that I work with. The office is open. You can come as often as you want to. If that's what works for you, is to be able to come in. Some people, they do better if they're not at home. That schedule, that structure, that helps me. And my office is available for me to go there. You have people, again, that need to have that connection with people, connection with others, love to be there. But maybe I need that flexibility where today is not the day, right? And we don't know when those days where mentally, I'm having a hard time getting out of bed, or mentally, I just can't make it in. But if I have this hard set rule that that day is Wednesday when that has to happen, right?
That's not the way life really works,
that's
right?
That's not the way life works. Exactly. You know, and I said this early on in my career, you know, one of my supervisors thought they were doing a good thing. Like, oh, get off, you know, leave early on Friday, da 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 da. And I'm like, that's great, you know, to leave early, start the weekend, but can we kind of pick what day we leave early? Because some days I may need to live on a Wednesday because I may need to go run errands on that day or have an appointment. And this is before work from home was even, you know, this was years and years ago. But I'm like, why does it have to be Friday? I know that sounds good to have an early weekend, but can some of those days, can we choose what that day is? Because actually that works with my life, is if I can choose what that day is, because maybe my child has a game or something like that, you know, that I want to attend. So it needs to be as individualized as possible. And I realize we can't just flex to everyone's individual needs. But as a team leader, I say, you know, first of all, try not to make it organization-wide. Try to make it department-wide. Try to make sure that your leaders are talking to each other, where at least one department is not, oh, completely remote, do whatever you want to do, and this department is 2 days, right? Have it where it just makes sense for your business, for your team, as much as possible. And then come back together, like you stated, and calibrate as much as you can till you can find as close of a sweet spot. Not everyone will be pleased, and the organization won't be 100% pleased, but let's try to get as close there as your workforce sees that you're continuing to have this these conversations, you're moving forward, you're adjusting, you're agile. Guess what? They will be too, right? You'll start to see that happen. You'll start to see, okay, you know what? If they're willing to be flexible and agile, I'm willing to be flexible and agile. And then it'll start to happen organically.
I like that. Yeah, that's particularly valuable advice for leaders who may be a little bit reluctant. Yeah, I really appreciate that you're saying that it's like, you know, test the waters, see what works, and then you'll continue to develop that. It's almost like building your agility muscle as a leader.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
So have you seen some organizations that are stepping up, doing well in this domain, or some teams that are doing well?
I'm seeing some, and I work with a lot of organizations that that it's possible to have the flexibility that's needed. So I work with a lot of marketing, advertising, creative field. And those are a little easier, right, than some of your or other types of industries, let's say healthcare, where you have an executive team and they can do these things remotely, but it's, you've got this other part of the population or the workforce that can't. You can't tell a nurse that they can work from home. I've helped even healthcare organizations to help their nurses to become more flexible. So let's say you're working on the cardiac floor. You're looking at some of those roles that traditionally you think you have to be there, but there are certain parts of your day where you're not having that one-to-one patient contact. So is that where I can do those things remotely? So they're putting things in place and programs in place where you're still protecting patient privacy, but I can monitor you remotely, right? So those are the things, if you want to be creative, and then you can rotate that. Well, today I get to do this and I get to monitor and you're doing the contact, and then we switch, right? So those are some of the things that organizations that are understanding that, hey, we need to figure out a way. Because I realized, and even with my son, who's, you know, a blue collar service worker, I think about the things that I talk about and they just don't apply to him. And there's a huge population of people like that. And as we're talking about this, I feel like this whole conversation is almost elitist, right? We're talking to people, only a certain small slice. And it was only as I was talking to him and he came to visit me over the holiday and took a week off work. He doesn't have PTO. And it's like, oh, mom, I'm going to have a hard time making rent because I was, you know, I took a week off from work, but it wasn't PTO. I'm not eligible for that. And that made me realize when I'm having these conversations, I'm talking to a small piece of the population that even has access to this flexibility, right? So that's why we've got to dig deeper. Yes, hybrid work from home is a piece of workplace wellness, but that's why I stand on, we've got to talk about culture. Because you have a large piece of the pie of people that's got to go into that workplace every day. They've got to, you know, deal with their manager every day. There's no avoiding people. So with that being said, how do we make sure that that culture is healthy, psychologically safe, and all those things that still feed into their mental well-being, right? And then what are some of those other benefits to make sure, hey, I can take a week off work without, you know, worried about how am I going to pay my bills? I'm being paid in an equitable way, right? So all of those things are still things we need to look at that feed into mental health. The conversation has to expand beyond this elitist type of, oh yeah, I have a degree, I have a desk job, and I can do all this. Because what happens to the three-fourths of the population that doesn't have that flexibility?
No, I totally appreciate that. It's funny because you're bringing up a memory in me about when I was in college and I was working, you know, in a restaurant kind of job in order to pay the bills and in order to have time for studying. And I was very fortunate, I think, because I had a really good boss who created, and I'm loving this because I'm going to reflect on, after this discussion, I'm going to reflect on what was it that she did, as an amazing female leader, to create such a great environment, because we had a lot of fun at work. We actually, she was playful, she was flexible. It was not an easy job being a waiter or a bartender or any of those kind of jobs, but because the leadership was good, people enjoyed it. But you're right, the culture and the environment that the leadership created makes all the difference.
I had office jobs, but at nights and weekends, I worked in retail, you know, at department stores until I went to law school. And I mean, I enjoyed it. I mean, I had a good camaraderie with my coworkers. We would laugh, talk, our bosses, and it was just, it was fun. I didn't, you know, dread going there. You know, even after leaving a full-time job, I would go there, work from 6 to 9 at night, work on the weekend, essentially working 7 days a week. But I don't look back at that time like, oh, that was just horrible, you know, because of that culture there. It gave me the supplemental income that I needed till I went to law school. And I built friendships while I was there. So we can do this, but I've got to remember, and it helped to shape my leadership style, right? Because even as I made it through into the C-suite, I had a environmental services worker person that came every day and took out my trash and did all that. But I would always stop them like, oh, hey, what's, you know, how are the, I knew the kids' names and we enjoy certain sports teams. So I made sure to have that conversation when they came in. And it was just natural to me, you know, and my mother came to visit one day and they're like, oh, I just love your daughter because I've worked here for such and such amount of years. I've seen people in and out of this office. She's the only one that actually stops me every day and is interested in my life other than me taking out the trash. And I just thought about, because, yeah, I've been that person to take out. My first job was like setting the breakfast at a hotel. You know, I've done all these jobs before. And but I feel bad. I thought about it only after my son came. I'm like, I'm having these conversations, but I am leaving out a large part, and I talk about culture, but I've got to double down on that because it always shifts to this whole flexibility and all these things, but there just is too many people that don't have access to that. And that's why we've got to double down on culture.
So let's wrap up our conversation with getting your expert tips, because, you know, the coaches that are listening to this call are going to be either already coaching leaders who hopefully want to be more effective in creating a workplace environment that fosters well-being, or they're interested in becoming a coach or growing their practice in these different industries where, like you said, it can be, we run the gamut from service industry to healthcare to knowledge worker. So leave us with some tips, because you are at the vanguard in all these different environments. How do you, what are some of the key things you think are crucial?
Assessment. Do not make assumptions of what you need to do or what you need to coach your clients or what your clients should be doing. You've got to assess. You've got to do a needs assessment. Let's not make assumptions. Let's make sure that assessment is broken down by demographic, because you need to understand that some people have different experiences than others. So you need to make sure that you're capturing that by demographic. That's number one. Number two, you've got to help your organizational leaders to instill trust in their workforce. Trust is a major issue that is happening right now. There were lots of commitments that were made a few years ago in 2020. Organizations are dialing back on that. How do you regain trust, right? If your organizational leaders that you're coaching are doing that, right? And three is to make sure that you are staying on top of what's happening. Be present where people are sharing their stories and experiences with you, because that's probably what's the most helpful to me is the DMs that I get. And I'm hearing what's happening. You can't be in 1,000 places at one time, but you can hear from all of these different places, from people, of what's working, what's not working. And that's really what helps to drive my work. When someone reaches out to me and says, my organization is implementing this or doing this, this works, I feel so much better. Great, I can use that and take that. Or my organization is not doing this and it's impacting my mental health. So being present, right? And ensuring that you're hearing not just from your clients, but you're hearing from a gamut of people, you're following other coaches and people in this field, and you're reading the comments and their posts. That's tons of information, and you're kind of crowdsourcing this that can help you. Don't rely just on your clients, because you got to understand what's going on holistically. And that's what I really take the time out to do.
That's awesome. Yeah, no. So I'm taking away, and I hope our listeners will take away, you know, to create a workplace environment that fosters well-being, we have to assess at a very granular level, not just general, but really assess the environment, assess the individuals and the people, uh-huh. Number one. We have to make an effort to build a sense of trust, psychological safety.
Yes.
And then we have to be constantly growing and listening, right? Being present. I love what you said about just being present and listening to what's working, what isn't working. And you spoke about this earlier, but I think you're also encapsulating being flexible, like being willing to change. So great. Oh my God, this is so great. I could talk to you for hours.
Well, let's definitely do it again. I love having conversations with you. So
we will definitely do it again. So Thank you so much, Natasha, for joining us. You know, you're, as I said, you're at the vanguard of what I consider to be, and I think my colleagues at the Institute of Coaching and my tribe of coaches think to be really crucial, important element of our work, which is to change the workplace environment and to foster well-being at all levels.
Oh, well, thank you for that, for your support and the Institute of Coaching support and everything that they do to support.
Well, thank you for coming back to see us again, and we will talk to you again soon.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, everyone, and stay tuned. Bye-bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Coaching Revealed, brought to you by the Institute of Coaching. You can learn more about the Institute on our website at instituteofcoaching.org. You can stay up to date with new episodes of our podcast by liking and following Coaching Revealed. You can also find us on social media, on LinkedIn, Instagram, and X with the handle Institute of Coaching. We also love hearing from our guests, so please reach out to us with thoughts you have on this episode and any questions you have about coaching. Until next time, this is Emily Tarani with Coaching Revealed.